From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, conspiracies or fact? Has Planet X been found? An amazing story tonight. Researchers at the California Institute of Technology have apparently found evidence in the outer solar system of an object that could be a real ninth planet. Now remember, they downgraded Pluto. So that means, I think, still 10. Nicknamed Planet Nine, it has a mass of about 10 times that of Earth, orbits about 20 times farther from the sun than Neptune, and that means it would take this new planet 10 to 20,000 years to make just one full orbit around the sun. Now, the researchers, Konstantin Batygin and Mike Brown, haven't actually seen the planet, but other research helped lead them to conclude that there is one. Basically, they found that certain objects in the Kuiper Belt, now that's the field of icy objects and debris way beyond Neptune, had orbits that particularly pointed in the same direction. Now, over time, mathematical modeling and computer simulation led them to this conclusion, that a planet was exerting the gravity necessary to shape these orbits. Brown says that there have only been two true planets discovered since ancient times, and this would be the third. They say it's a pretty substantial chunk of our solar system that's still out there to be found, and that's pretty exciting. I think it really is, too. You know, you think about the work of Zechariah Sitchin and so many other people who have talked about Planet X. I think it's there. The cost of using scented candles to keep your house smelling fresh could be much higher than just the price tag. According to a new study, scented candles might give off more than just a pleasant aroma. They can react with other elements in the air to create a cancer-causing agent, formaldehyde in the air. Now, that's used to embalm people. But, according to the FDA, formaldehyde can also be associated with several types of cancer. So be careful. As people in the South and the East ready themselves for a nor'easter that might bring heavy snowfall by week's end, snow fell on much of Kentucky and Tennessee and contributed to at least one, so far, traffic-related death. The National Weather Service Prediction Center's warning of heavy, perhaps crippling snow across the northern mid-Atlantic region, including folks in Baltimore, Washington, Philadelphia, probably beginning Friday. Climate change, global temperatures in 2015, especially December, were the warmest on record, according to data published by the meteorologists in the United Kingdom and the U.S., and the world's first farmers and their slash-and-burn agriculture that they had may have set off global warming. Now, wait a minute. This is way before we had a lot of people on the planet, way before coal-fired power plants. But they say new analysis of ice core climate data shows that archaeological evidence and ancient pollen samples being used to suggest that farming 7,000 years ago help put the brakes on a natural cooling process of the global climate, possibly contributing, they say, to the warmer climate seen today. So blame them. Dr. Tim Ball, of course, environmental consultant and expert on climates. What do you think of all of this warming, Tim? So maybe we had a warm December and a warmer year, but what's the cause?
Well, the cause is politics. One of the problems that, of course, they had the commitment in Paris, and they all agreed to allow Obama to have his legacy agenda of global warming and climate change. But they were confronted by the problem that the record has not shown any increase in temperature for 20 years now. And so what happened was that NOAA came out with a claim that, in fact, there was no leveling of temperature for the last 20 years, that it had continued to increase. And they put out a paper to that effect. That was led by Thomas Cole at NOAA. And Lamar Smith, the congressman, said, look, we want to see your data. How did you come up with that? Because other people that have looked at it said it's just nonsense. And they've refused to provide the data to Lamar Smith's congressional committee on what they've done. And so they had to come out and say 2015 was the warmest on your record, when the four other official measures of global temperature are not showing the same thing at all. It's only the one that's showing that 2015 was the warmest on record. And it's because, as I said, they adjusted the record from 20 years ago and earlier to make it look like the warming was continuing to occur. But if you put this in a historic context, it definitely wasn't the warmest year compared to what it was like in the medieval warm period 1,000 years ago. And, of course, these same people are the ones that tried to eliminate that from the historic record with the infamous hockey stick.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Tim.
Right? Yeah, sorry. And then when you go back 10,000 years, in fact, 2015 is in the 3% of the coldest years in the last 10,000 years. So that whole argument about 2015 being the warmest year on record is getting headlines, but only because it suits the political agenda. The other question about agriculture, which of course
7,000 years ago.
Yeah, which of course is associated with the triangle in the Middle East, which is now actually Iran and Iraq and those regions. That is where sedentary agriculture began, and the William Redeman, who's been pushing this argument for some time that it's human agriculture that's caused the warming and the change of climate, ignores the fact that the agriculture started because the climate changed, not the other way around. The switch from hunter-gatherer to sedentary agriculture was brought about by the ability to harvest the new grains that were growing with the changing climate in the Middle East. And that's been in the literature for a very, very long time.
Good insight, Tim. Thank you so much. Appreciate that. The Taliban has claimed responsibility for an attack by multiple gunmen that killed at least 20 people at a university in northwestern Pakistan. We were on the air late last night when this occurred. In addition to the victims, Pakistan police say four attackers had been killed. Now, the Taliban is denying that they were responsible for this. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, which has lost more than 550 points today and then made a rebound, getting back only about half of that as the rally trimmed its losses, but a lot of it because of sinking oil prices, which now have sank to a 13-year low. The Dow ultimately fell 249 points. Energy companies were pummeled. People aren't happy. They're skittish. Let's check in with not an investment advisor tonight, Howard Bloom, of course, an expert on the brain. I think we're in a cycle here, Howard, where people are going to panic. What do you think?
It's a psychological cycle. You put your finger on it. Panic is the word because panic relates to an emotion. Let me give you a really scary statistic. The market is down a total of 2,546 points from its all-time high of 18,312.39. That was May 19th, 2015, which means hold on to your socks. The American market has lost $3.6 trillion in value in 8 months.
Ouch.
Which is more than the gross domestic product of one of the strongest economies on the face of the earth, Germany. And yet things are not as bad as we think they are. I mean, look, it all comes down to biology. Bacteria, bees, birds, lizards, rabbits all go through boom and bust cycles. And we've been doing it as long as there's been human history.
That's right.
All the way back to the Romans and before. And in our case, the market is nearly three times as high as it was only 7 years ago. And then we have the claims that we've added 13 million jobs to the economy since the Great Recession, and we've added 290 million last month. Now, we're obsessed with China's growth rate, and we're panicking over China's growth rate. China reported yesterday that its growth rate was a mere 6.9%, down from 10%. Well, let's imagine that it's even worse than that. That China's growth rate is as low as 6%. It will add the equivalent of the entire economy of Taiwan or Argentina to its gross domestic product every single year. So we humans and all us animals, our bacterial ancestors 4.1 billion years ago, use fusion-fission search strategies. First we stretch out and explore, we get exuberant, we speculate, we think that everything's going to make us rich, then we panic, all on our own.
That's what's happening.
Without any necessary outside environmental cues. And we come rustling, running back to each other. We see every conceivable danger around us, and there's a value to that, because we build safety nets. And once we built the safety nets, we go out and speculate and explore again, and the result is every 68 years, there is a major depression, and roughly every 5 years, there's a cycle of recession, and we're overdue for the recession that comes after the 2007 and 2008 Great Recession.
Well, here we go. Howard, thanks. I always appreciate your insight, too. Story at our highlight reel at coasttocoastdam.com. Go take a look at it. The controversial neurosurgeon who's been on our program before, Sergio Canavero, claims that he successfully oversaw a monkey head transplant and that the operation now paves the way for future surgeries on people. The doctor and his team of researchers revealed the experiment with an unsettling image of the monkey test subject after surgery. The team also unveiled footage of lab mice that had apparently undergone an operation to solve the issue of reattaching the spinal cord. Dr. Canavero sees the surgery as proof that head transplants for humans are not only possible, but inevitable. Wow. And, you know, we've talked about Project MK Ultra, sometimes referred as the CIA's mind control program. It was a code given to an illegal program of experiments on human subjects. One such human, Matthew Pauley, is next with us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Matthew Pauley graduated in the mid-1980s with a degree in sociology and computer studies. He held positions from programmer to chief scientist, consults for Fortune 500 companies. Matthew's decade of non-consensual involvement in MKUltra mind control tests began back in November of 2005 in Toronto, in the back of a 5-ton armored military van as a test subject. Well, here he is to talk about that. His book is called The Murder of Time. Matthew, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, George. I'm glad to have the opportunity to talk to you. Thank you.
I'm disturbed that this program apparently continued, because we've always been told that MKUltra ended in 1973, yet they grabbed you in 2005. What happened?
Well, exactly. From my bit of experience, I would say that the statement that it stopped in front of the U.S. Senate committee, the Church Committee hearings, the CIA gave testimony saying it had stopped. That was apparently not true. In fact, my bit of research has shown a former deputy director, Victor Marchetti, claims publicly that this is a cover story. And you can read all about that at wantoknow.info, which is a really good site with declassified CIA documents. We also know... Well, there's been reports of other people who've come forward, such as Kathy O'Brien, Kathleen Sullivan. There's been a handful of published books, like I have just done, detailing their experience after the date the CIA said they'd stopped MKUltra.
Matthew, let's go back a little bit for people who aren't familiar with MKUltra and tell us about these experiments on humans and what they wanted to accomplish.
Sure. Well, I mean, it actually started back with the ancient Egyptians. They were using torture, trauma-based mind control to make slaves. What the CIA's MKUltra program is about is basically picking up from the work of Dr. Josef, I can hardly get this last name, Mengele. Dr. Josef Mengele was
Nazi.
Nazi, yes, a sadist who was in the World War II concentration camps doing experiments on typically twin Jewish children. And he was really pioneering this torture to cause the subject to dissociate, which means that the dominant personality I mean, if you get tortured enough, anybody tortured enough will eventually dissociate, and which means that it's a self-protection mechanism mm-hmm. of the human mind.
Yes.
And when the dominant personality goes to sleep, what's left over is a very malleable infant, or not infant, but like a childlike presence that's easily hypnotized. And you have very little resistance to hypnotism once you've been dissociated. And so once you're able to be hypnotized, then you can be forced to repeat post-hypnotic suggestions, which are suggestions in the first person. When I hear toots of an air horn, I will go and wring this person's neck, for example. And what happens is you repeat that about a dozen times in the first person, and at the very end they make you repeat a suggestion which says, I will not remember this suggestion until the trigger is present. And then you say it again, I will not remember this suggestion until the trigger is present. And you say that over and over again, and then what happens is when you come out of that dissociation period and your dominant personality comes back, you have no memory in your conscious mind of the entire dissociative event. You have what's called missing time. And that's why I call my book The Murder of Time, Making and Unmasking a Sleeper.
Were they making Manchurian candidates, Matthew?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there's been so many instances in history and that we've seen where people are shown to be by the press and by the courts to be guilty of a crime that really doesn't make much sense. Why would they do this? And yet they are there. I mean, they apparently did it. You know, that's the way it's sold in the press. Because, you know, if you're going to do an assassination, it's not a good thing if it comes off as it looks like, you know, that it was, say, a systemic assassination and the part of the government did it. You have to have it look like some, you know, person who is usually tarted up with some ideology.
That's right.
Going right back to JFK. There's so many of these assassinations where the person is tarted up as either a Marxist or lately, of course, Islamicist with the San Bernardino thing. But these people are really patsies, and there's actual professionals that are doing these killings.
Now, that's what Oswald called himself after he was arrested. He was being led in and said, I'm a patsy. And a lot of people looked at that and went, wow, well, MK Ultra apparently was researched at 80 institutions, 44 colleges and universities, hospitals, prisons, pharmaceutical companies. That's pretty widespread.
Exactly. I mean, it's really daunting, the scope of this project. And in fact, here in Canada in the 1950s and 1960s at the Allan Memorial Institute in Montreal and also the Royal Victoria Hospital in Montreal, there were thousands of Canadians who were experimented upon using mind control techniques by Dr. Ewan Cameron, who was funded by the CIA. And still to this day, psychiatrists are not taught about that involvement, and they don't even know that this happened in Canada. So it's actually, the scope of it is huge, as you point out. And in fact, I was just doing a little bit of poking around on my own my Facebook site, and I found that I had earlier posted this, and people want to see this, they can look at the Liberty, it's called the LibertyBeacon.com. If you put in that website, human experimentation, you'll find dozens and dozens and dozens of studies that have been published, footnoted with real good sources of human experimentation that's gone on. And some of that, of course, is MKUltra.
These are some of the... Go ahead.
The MK is thought to be a short form of mental control, which is a Latin Germanic phrase.
And these are some of the methods they use to manipulate people's mental states and brain functions. Drugs, chemicals, hypnosis, sleep deprivation, isolation, verbal and sexual abuse, torture. Unbelievable.
Yes. That's the thing, is that it's so far out there that most people can't believe that they would actually do these things. And that's why I encourage people to do actual research and or, you know, look at my book and read my book, because this is actually, not only is it historically gone on, and it's all out there in the public domain. You can read about these studies, these things that happened in North America, but it's still happening today. And I'm one of those people that for the last 10 years, my life has been turned upside down.
I believe that. Matthew, when we come back, I want you to tell us your story, how they grabbed you and how long you were in this program and how in the heck did you get out? Or did you? The name of the book is The Murder of Time, Making and Unmasking a Sleeper. Matthew Pauly is our guest right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast with Matthew Pauly. The name of his book is The Murder of Time. We're talking about the Project MK Ultra. So, Matthew, how did they get you involved in this? How did they grab you? What happened?
Sure. Well, in November of 2005, it happened, the first event. And what happened was I was walking on the street and just a few blocks from my house at 9:30 at night. And I was approached by two men. One was about 5'11", short blonde hair, blue eyes, and the other was taller, 6'4", 220 pounds, big guy, with a bit of a French accent. And they said, "Are you Matthew Pauly?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "We'd really like to know what you've got three bottles of hydrogen peroxide in your furnace room for." I said, "Well, okay, sure, I'll tell you the truth. I was using them as a disinfectant, you know. I was growing a fungus, actually, in a terrarium because my wife has severe migraine headaches and wasn't responding to conventional."
So you were going for the alternative end.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they said, "Well, look, you know, we just have a few more questions about that. And, you know, it's really cold outside. This is November 22nd, approximately. And so we have a van over here. You need to just come up with us in the van."
Oh.
Sure. So they said, "Walk in front of us." So I walked in front of them.
This is the whole thing's weird for you, right?
Yeah. And I stopped, and they said, "Go to this parking lot here across the street." It was actually a Canada Postal Station parking lot, which normally has three orange sodium lights full on all night long.
Okay, great.
Light sensor turned on, but they were all off this night. And I stopped at the boom, you know, the yellow and black diagonal boom to stop cars from going in. I said, "Is this okay?" "Oh, yeah, never mind. You know, go ahead. It's private property, right?" So I'm walking through this thing, this parking lot with all these darkened postal vans, and I said, "Is it one of these?" And they said, "No, just keep walking." And I decided to stop because I was getting uncomfortable, and that's when a guy yelled behind me, the big 6'4" guy, "Keep walking," really loud, and I kept walking.
So their whole mood changed towards you too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Once they had me in a place where no one could see me, they became very aggressive. As we went to the north side of that parking lot. This is between Orchard View and Montgomery, just off Yonge Street in Toronto, which is right the center of Toronto, literally. And there was this big 5-ton van. And I only know it's 5-ton because a Canadian military officer stopped me on the street and corrected my specification for my book in 2009. He had read it online. It was this huge armored van that was unmarked. And there was a guy holding the door open saying, "Hello, Matthew, come on in." And there was a guy on each side of the van, you know, east and west and north on the other side of the van. And, of course, two guys behind me. And I thought, okay, right, well, you know, I can get through this. I'll just, you know, tell them the truth, and this will be over in a minute. And so I got inside the van, and that's when my life changed. It was first the medical questionnaire. They had me sit down at a fold-down table and ask me all about medical conditions and medications I might be taking. And then they did this showing the tools of torture routine where they pulled out a fingernail puller. It was a hole punch with a flange removed. And they spread my fingers on the table and they examined each one of my fingers. The RCMP officer did that. And to see if they could pull one. And, of course, that was just to scare me, right? Because
right.
If they pulled one, they would have left evidence. I realize that now. At the time, I didn't realize that. I was terrified. And then they did this thing where they, you might have seen in a movie, where they spread my fingers on this table, and then they went, took a knife, and they went tap, 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 tap.
Right between them. Between them, yeah.
Yeah, between them. And they took turns. First, the Canadian went, the JTF2 guy, and then the American, the JTF officer, did this. And then they had me sit down on this throne chair. It was this, it had about 4-inch or 5-inch diameter, round diameter tubing on each side of the upper part, as well as about, I don't know, 3 or 4-inch tubing on the hand, like the armrests. And everywhere where my body touched the surface of his chair was black 3.5-inch wide seatbelt webbing. So there was no way I could get bruised. And then they attached, the RCMP officer attached the leg cuffs and then the handcuffs.
Are you screaming when this is going on, Matthew?
No, I'm not screaming. I was overwhelmed, really. And I thought, okay, this makes them feel more comfortable, you know. I'll just answer the questions and then this will be done with this.
Now, at what point are you saying to yourself, why am I here?
Oh, well, you see, there's some background here. I had a little bit of an expectation that this might occur. And the reason is that in August 2nd of 2005, there was a plane crash in Toronto. It was it's called an overrun. But, I mean, the whole plane was destroyed, so I think that's more like a crash. And it happened on August 2nd. I was working across from the airport on the fourth floor, which is the highest floor because we were so close to the airport. I witnessed this Air France 358 Airbus A310 go skidding down the runway out of control, 150-foot rooster tails of water spray, this hydroplane, go and knock down a light stand and then go across a bumpy field, disappear into a ravine and smoke starts.
That was the one where, thank God, everybody survived the crash.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. But at the time, from our vantage point, we didn't know that they survived the crash.
No.
All we saw was this plane out of control going into a ravine and smoke coming up. And it was like very traumatizing because it looked like these people were going to die. And I remember running out the stairwell of the software company where I was working as a programmer. And as I ran down the stairwell, I imagined all the people dying. And I felt so bad. I felt like I should be doing something, you know? Anyway, then, so I definitely had some post-traumatic stress kind of event there. And then only 2.5 weeks later on August 19th in Toronto, at the same workplace, we had a tornado evacuation.
Jeez.
Which is kind of rare for Toronto.
You're getting, especially in August.
Yeah, exactly. And a tornado touched down in Fergus, Ontario. And when it was coming towards the building, the team leader was kind of panicking and he was explaining, we're just going to evacuate our team, the Virgin 6 team. And I started arguing. I said, well, look, you know, if there's a threat to the building, we should be evacuating everybody, mm-hmm. not just ourselves.
That's right.
And he said, no, look, we've talked to them already. Look, you're on your own. Say you're on your own. Say yeah. I said, okay, fine, yeah, I'm on my own. So I stayed behind at that point, along with one other guy who stayed with me. And then we experienced something which is just unreal. I mean, it was, first of all, the streetlights were on. It was so black. And then when this thing started coming to the building, people just ran away. And basically, we started getting... you know, if you go through a car wash, you see the whirly mops going across the windshield?
Mm-hmm,
well, that's
sure.
What was happening on the fourth floor. We were seeing, like, leaves and debris, like garbage, everything rubbing across the windows. And then we hear as the air is sucking past the seals and the windows. And then we hear these gunshots. And what the gunshots are rocks, like gravel, hitting the windows. And it's just at that precise moment, both me and the other guy hit under our desk, a big thud as we went on the floor.
Man, you were in the eye of this thing.
Yeah, exactly. And so I'm lying under my desk, and everything's beige. The floor is beige. The ceiling, like the underside of the desk is beige. Anywhere I move, I can't escape the feeling of panic that, you know, the windows are going to break. And I went into shock. And after about 45 minutes, someone tried to get me out of shock. And they led me through to the same stairwell that I had gone when I'd seen the plane crash, which I wouldn't go through at this point because now I started to remember that event. Like, I actually sort of dissociated during the actual plane crash part when I went down the stairwell, and I'd forgotten that whole period. And all of a sudden, I remembered it, and I wouldn't go down the stairwell. And what happened, to make a long story short, was that the guy tried to force me the second time through with his arm. It forced me through this door. And I snapped because I was in deep shock. And I mean, the stairwell was like death to me. And I literally grabbed him by the lapels and pushed him really hard, and which was a terribly violent thing. And I feel very ashamed about that. But the point is that because I'd been violent, he grabbed a railing on the stairs and landed on his butt on the third or fourth stair. He did get a sprained arm.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, but he felt I should be interrogated because I'd been violent. And it turns out that this man was very, very skilled in interrogation. because he was, in fact, formerly in the Devil's Brigade in World War II. He was in his 70s.
Now, was he a member of this MK Ultra group?
Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. He was just a very, very dedicated, highly skilled special ops soldier.
All right, and this is going on before you've been picked up, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. But because I'd been violent, he felt I should be interrogated, and he took me down to a floor, another, like an empty floor in the building, and he got his 200-pound nephew to come to work right away. I'm still partly in shock because the team came back up from the basement, and they are all Chinese, and they know a rapid massage technique to get someone mostly out of shock. So I was about three-quarters of the way out of shock. I was in mild shock, and he took me to this floor. He starts interrogating me, and I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to lose my job as a programmer here because I'm going to be charged with assault. And you can't have a criminal record and be a programmer in
high-security
environments. So I felt I had to give him something to distract him, which was kind of stupid, but I was in a, like I say, I was not all there. I was in mild shock. So I kind of exaggerated the discussion that I'd had with a friend 10 years earlier in 1995. About a neoconservative politician that we both disliked. And I kind of, how shall we say, made it sound like me and my friend back then, 10 years earlier, had made plans, and which was, you know, not true. But I said that because I was, you know, irrational and trying to distract him. And anyway, at that moment, I became tagged as a potential terrorist. And this was on August 19th of 2005.
As a terrorist?
September 22nd.
Unbelievable, Matt.
And in October, this same guy, Gary, called me up at home. And he said, Matthew, have you been interrogated yet? And I said, oh, by whom? And he said, by the authorities. And I said, no. No, both guys. Oh, okay, bye, Matthew, click. And he hangs up. And that was in October. And then November 22nd, actually just before I got picked up in that van, 2 or 3 weeks earlier, a guy from the gas company, he was a guy who said he was from the gas company, pulled in front of my house, came to the door and explained there was a new energy conservation program. He just wanted to have a look in my furnace room and adjust the temperature on my hot water heater and put some low flow aerators on my taps. I let him in. He came downstairs to the furnace room and he wanted to be alone in there. He told me to go upstairs to the turn on the bathtub, the hot water. Anyway, he's the guy who spotted the three balls of hydrogen peroxide. And when I came back down, you know, he was all kind of acting furtive and weird. And he had me sign this invoice in triplicate, $0, and got my signature. And then he quickly left. That was about 3 weeks before November 22nd. And then November 22nd is when I was picked up.
So they knew you. They were targeting you.
They had targeted me. And furthermore, this is an important point. Common to almost all of the MKUltra victims that I've spoken to, and I've spoken to about a half dozen in the past year. I mean, these are people who are verified, like I verified them, that they're totally legit. We all have a history of severe trauma in our childhood. And the reason why that's important as a selection criterion is dissociation is like splitting a round of wood. You know, if you're camping and you split a round of wood, the first time you split that round, it's really, really hard because it's, you know, it's all round and it's really hard. You have to wedge it sometimes, use a real wedge or something. It's really hard to get split it. But once you've split that once, you could take the half piece now to take your axe and it splits a lot easier. And then if you take that quarter piece and you split it, oh, it splits a lot easier, right? Well, it's the same thing with dissociation. So that if you have a childhood history of severe trauma, you have it dissociated already in your life, so that now you'll dissociate under torture quicker, significantly faster than a regular person would. And so they knew this as well, because in the interrogation by this Gary in the workplace, he asked me about, you know, childhood stuff, and I mentioned that I had severe trauma. So he would have reported that as well. And so that made me the perfect candidate for a Manchurian candidate research subject.
So while they're interrogating you, and again, everybody thinks the program ends in 73, something's going on. What do you think they want with you at this point?
I should just say that after they clasped me down with the handcuffs and leg cuffs,
now, this is in the van, or where are you?
Van,
you're still
in
the van.
They also put in a 100cc syringe in my upper, like in the vein inside the left, just opposite the elbow.
What was in that syringe?
Sodium pentothal.
The only
and
truth,
perhaps
sir.
Another cocktail item, maybe an upper, but for sure sodium pentothal, based on what had happened, like the effect, and also because when I saw it, the first thing I said to the RCMP officer, is that sodium pentothal? And he said, did you have sodium pentothal before? And I said, no. Well, then why are you asking? Like, he was being cagey about it. The other thing that they did was they put a shocking cuff, electroshock cuff, on my upper right arm. They also taped open my eyelids. The RCMP officer did this. He taped open my eyelids. And then they proceeded to have three bright floodlights in my
eyes.
Jeez,
this is a horror story.
Yes.
And by the way, if anybody has ever had an eye exam, when they flash an extremely bright light in your eyes and they keep your eyes open, it's painful.
You're darn right it's painful. It's very painful. And when your eyes are taped open, they have to drop in drops of lubricant, right? And the RCMP officer says, I'm going to drop these lubricants, the drops of eye drops in your eyes. He'd stored them in the upper part of the van, which like in the, they had like you know, like overhead luggage in an aircraft.
So they're freezing.
But those things were unheated. It was November 26th. So this stuff was near 0 degrees.
Oh, liquid ice.
It was painful when it dropped in. But that wasn't it. I also got actual physical assault. I mean, it was brutal.
Well, now, let me ask you this, though, Matthew. Did they take you away? Did they keep you for an inordinate amount of time, or did they let you go?
3.5 hours.
Okay.
And that was event number one. And in that 3.5 hours, the first hour was an Arab-style, like an Islamic terrorist kind of interrogation. Now, the Joint Task Force, the JTF, runs Guantanamo Bay.
They didn't waterboard you, though, did they?
They didn't waterboard me, thankfully. That would have been messy. But they did all this torture on me. And now, this is the first part of it was always questions about, you know, do you belong to Hamas? Do you belong to Hezbollah?
Jeez.
Do you belong to Al-Qaeda? But they'd asked the same question a dozen different ways. And they went through a terrorist list, I swear. It must have been 30 or 40 long.
You're not Middle Eastern either, are you?
Not at all.
Okay.
I'm a WASP. My father is you know, from Chicago. He's a professor in sociology or anthropology, cultural anthropology to be precise. And my mother is also, they're both Americans. And like this was so on left field. So it was a training exercise, right? Because I know this is because I found it on the Department of National Defense, the Canadian DND site in 2006. And it was called Joint Control Unified Command. And it was described as having enhanced interrogation techniques and group infiltration.
So you think they were training these two guys?
They were. The American JTF was clearly training the JTF to the Canadian officer.
And you were the experiment.
And I was the test subject for the experiment, precisely. But the thing is, it didn't just stop at interrogation. Part two of this was mind control. The American demonstrated to the Canadian how to do torture, trauma, MK-Ultra Monarch-style mind control to turn me into a sleeper. And I was after I was tortured down to dissociation, where the way they did it was they just asked me a nonsensical question, what is your Arabic name, which I don't have one, right? And it didn't matter if I said, you know, Mohash, which is the one they actually gave me the translation of my name, Matthew, into Arabic, or if I said Matthew, or if I said nothing. I would get arbitrarily shocked about once out of every two or three times. And what happens to the brain is when you get pain, no matter, you keep being confronted with a question, and no matter what your response is, you get random pain. Eventually, after 10 or 15 minutes, you regress, and you literally turn into like a child.
Oh, you're in mush. You turn to mush.
You turn to mush, and you become dissociated.
So this was the first time. How many times did they come and grab you?
2005 was that time in November. Again in 2006. Now, interesting. Sorry, 2007. Now, in total, about five times. In 2007, I had just sent my first draft of my book to my editor at that time.
Based on what happened to you?
Based on what happened to date, right? And what happens is I get picked up off the street on King Street, which is like Main Street in Toronto.
Hold on, Matthew. We're at the break. We'll talk more about this Project MK Ultra, and we'll take some phone calls with you, too.